On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Declaration anticipation, a terror plot, and a senator in trouble in the news this week. On Jay Leno and online, Fred Thompson got down to business, making his presidential bid official.
My friends, I come to you today to tell you that I intend to run for president. I feel deeply that I'm doing it for the right reasons. I love my country, and I'm concerned about its future.
German officials say they foiled a terror plot targeting Americans in Germany.
Ganz offensichtlich sind die Täter und das.
Very clearly, the perpetrators, perhaps in contrast to the so-called suitcase bombers last year, were highly professional.
And in a leaked voicemail, Idaho Republican Senator Larry Craig tried in vain to salvage his career.
Billy, this is Larry Craig calling. You can reach me on my cell. Arlen Specter is now willing to come out in my defense, arguing that it appears by all that he knows I've been railroaded.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the headlines. Joining us today from Washington is Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time Magazine. Karen, great to have you back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me back, Tom.
With us from Philadelphia is Trudy Rubin, foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, author of Willful Blindness, the Bush Administration, and Iraq. Trudy, great to have you back as well.
Same here, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Karen, and Trudy.
Let's go straight to the tape today. The week kind of begins with the president showing up in, of course, or of all places, Iraq. A surprise visit. President says he's waiting for this big progress report from General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker. Here's how he looks at it.
They believe that the security situation is changing quite dramatically, and they recognize as well there's more political reconciliation work to be done. And so, they'll come and report, and I will take their recommendations and put it into a speech to the country and explain the way forward.
All kinds of receptions to that. Here's Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell saying that Congress voted to have President General Petraeus report back next week, and they'll wait to hear what he has to say.
And the Congress should listen to what he says without prejudice when he gets here. This isn't a baseless hope. We've seen some of the sharpest early critics of the general's new military strategy defending it in recent weeks after seeing for themselves the impact it's had in former al-Qaeda strongholds like Anbar province.
Our president is reported telling, or in the Sydney Morning Herald in Australia, where he's been at the APEC conference, telling Australia's deputy prime minister that we're kicking ass in Iraq. New York Democrat Charles Schumer said Republicans won't acknowledge that the surge is not a success.
Why isn't it apparent to my colleagues on the other side of the aisle that the stated goal of the surge is failing? Strengthening the central government is not happening. As the surge and number of troops goes up, the strength of the central government goes down. That equation says failure in the Bush-Petraeus surge.
Trudy Rubin, Dana Milbank this week calling the whole reports of generals a kind of Rorschach test. But what do you see emerging? Even before Petraeus sits down before Congress, is there a new consensus coming up here?
I think there is a sort of new consensus coming up. I think the problem is it is so difficult to plow through all the contradictory information coming in. And even though the reports that have come out this week, Marine Corps General James Jones, Independent Commission reporting to Congress, the GAO report, there's a lot of negative stuff. I think everyone is trying to parse what does unbar the progress there mean? Can it be translated elsewhere? Nobody wants a total failure in Iraq. Everybody knows what that means. And so I think Democrats are looking sideways, trying to see if there's some way to come up with a consensus formula. You see these little feelers going out. Even the American Enterprise Institute yesterday had a consensus meeting with a critic, someone with a different policy, closer to the Democrats, coming on one of their panels. So people are grappling, and I hope, as a commentator, I hope that the focus is on, is there anything that can be salvaged and how best to do it, rather than who can dump on who faster in the presidential campaign. Not sure that will happen, but little signs.
Karen Tumulty, how do you read the Democrats here? At the beginning of the year, there was, you know, fierce opposition to the surge at all. At the beginning of the summer, it seemed that they were on a roll toward really pushing hard for some kind of pullback with Republican support at some point. Now we're hearing maybe a drawdown of 4,000 early next year, maybe back to pre-surge levels by next fall. But that just puts us back where we were at the beginning of 2007.
That's exactly right, Tom. I think that the Democrats, having been frustrated by the president's veto in their earlier effort, they passed a bill that set some deadlines. The president vetoed it. That made it very clear that to really get something done, they needed to not only get the 60 votes you need to get past a filibuster in the Senate, but the 67 that you need to get past a presidential veto. Their hope was that the August recess would be a time in which Republicans would go home to their districts. They would really hear from their constituents who are very angry about the war, and that they would come back essentially with, you know, steel in their spines, ready to put really strict deadlines. That's not happening, in part because of all the mixed signals that are coming out of these various reports from Iraq. And also, you know, because there were some Democratic members who went over to Iraq during this recess and said, yes, indeed, there is, in fact, military progress being made. There's, you know, if a case to be made that on the political process is going backwards. But the situation itself is so muddied right now that I think, you know, you're even hearing the presidential candidates saying that we're going to have a lot of troops in Iraq for a long time.
Jack, I want to get you on this, but let's listen first to retired Marine General James Jones. He led a 20-member independent commission asked by the Congress to go out and report to the Senate Armed Services Committee this week. He said Iraq is torn by sectarian violence, political reconciliation still critical and absent.
The consensus opinion of the commission is that the most positive event that can occur in the near term to influence progress in Iraq is a government-led political reconciliation which leads to an end or a dramatic reduction in sectarian violence. Everything seems to flow from this point, to include the likelihood of a successful conclusion to our mission.
Everything flows from that, but that's the one thing nearly everyone agrees is not. We have not seen progress on. Senator John McCain, during that hearing, who, of course, he supports the war, he questioned General Jones about pulling out of Iraq.
Do you believe that if we just set a time frame for withdrawal, that that would be in the United States' interest in the region?
Senator, I'll speak for myself on this, but I think deadlines can work against us. And I think a deadline of this magnitude would be against our national interest.
Jack Beatty, what do you see in the muddy water here?
Well, I think the water is muddy, partly because the administration is deliberately muddying it. Yesterday's Washington Post had an eye-opening piece by Karen DeYoung in which she quoted an intelligence analyst, or many of them, about the way the administration has been cooking the numbers here. And this fellow said to her, if a bullet went through the back of your head, it's a sectarian killing. If it went through the front, it's a criminal killing. The statistics the administration uses don't include death by car bombs. They don't include Sunnis killed by Sunnis or Shiites killed by Shiites. This is a propaganda exercise of massive proportions. And I think that the sight of General Petraeus will unnerve the Democrats, who already are losing their nerve. And I suspect that this next week could be the week that decides the presidential election, indeed, because I think that what you're going to see is a very demoralized Democratic Party as they face the fact that even in the face of statistics like this, 51% of Iowa Republicans want the United States out of there in 6 months. Even in the face of that sort of public opinion, the Democrats are basically, I think, capitulating to Bush. Bush.
We'll look at the political fallout here. Of course, the president's saying this will be decided by the generals and not what politicians have to say.
Those decisions will be based on a calm assessment by our military commanders on the conditions on the ground, not a nervous reaction by Washington politicians to poll results in the media.
Rhode Island Democratic Senator Jack Reed, who also visited Iraq over the summer, said he does not expect an independent assessment from General Petraeus.
Ultimately, it'll be the president's report, the president's views. I can't see him coming in here and differing from the president. So I don't think he'll be objective. I think what he'll be is careful to argue that the surge has been a success.
Trudy Rubin, capitulation, realpolitik, coming to terms with the, you know, real sticky wicket. How do you see what's happening?
You know, look, you have to look at what's happening on the ground in Iraq. I'm as skeptical as anyone. I was there in June. It was my eighth trip. I know that everyone says that Anbar is a special case, and in many ways Anbar province is. It's all Sunni. That means there's no civil war going on there, which makes it easier to deal with. But I can tell you, you know, I was there a year ago in June, and tribal leaders there were begging to have the Americans work with them against al-Qaeda in Iraq. And the U.S. military was unwilling to do it at that point. I was told by a senior general, you can't trust those tribes people.
Mm. We're looking at a week in the news. Trudy Rubin of the Philadelphia Inquirer is with us. Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time Magazine, and Jack Beatty. Let's just get Lindsey Graham in for a second here, and then we'll get your important thing. Here's the South Carolina Republican, doing a whole lot of cheerleading this week about the situation in Iraq.
Let's keep pouring it on militarily, politically, and economically. We got the enemy on the mat. Let's don't let them up, and morale is sky high. So now's the time, I think, for America to exercise some good judgment, long-term thinking, and reinforce Iraq instead of withdraw. And I think the message to withdraw, no matter how well intended, will not push the Iraqi politicians to do anything faster. It will reignite and encourage a insurgency that really is now being diminished.
Enemy on the mat? I don't know. Trudy Rubin, where do you go?
There are many enemies. I mean, the problem is that the Republicans overdo it in terms of how well things are going. So then there's a counter-reaction on the Democratic side. Mm-hmm. I think what Ambassador Crocker is going to talk about, there's going to be an effort to replicate what happened in Anbar with Shiites against radical Shiite militias. The radical cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has to back off now because his people have gotten out of hand and are alienating their own people.
In other words, there was so much violence by the al-Qaeda Sunnis that other Sunnis turned on them, so they're hoping moderate Shiites will turn against radical Shiites.
It's happening to some extent. Tribes, Shiite tribes in areas where Shiite tribes are important in the cities, local Shiite groups who are really angry because the Jaish Mahdi, the Mahdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr, is killing Shiites too now if they don't accept the thuggery. So I think the hope is that they can pour money now into Shiite provinces and try to align with, frankly, the more moderate militias against the Iranian-backed radical militias and sort of work province by province and then work into the center. It is a long shot. But the fact that there are some elements of progress in the strategy, I believe that a pullout will be disastrous. I don't think it will make things better. I think it'll make the region worse. And so the question is, do you give it more time?
Let's go to Steve in Arlington, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and your guests. I'm interested in your guess. This relates to Bush's kicking blank in Australia, his comments.
His comment to the Deputy Prime Minister as reported in the Sydney Morning Herald, yes.
Right. I'm wondering what your guests feel, that regardless of how we proceed, regardless of whether we decide that the Republican version or the Democratic version of these reports are accurate, don't we need some public acknowledgement that things have gone bad and that Bush is responsible for this and that the Congress has to make that statement that we've gotten in a very bad situation, and instead of trying to say someone's version is accurate, can we first start by some kind of catharsis?
Yeah, it is kind of annoying, to say the very least, that so much universally acknowledged mishandling kind of floats away. But it has been articulated. Majority Leader Harry Reid was saying this week that the generals can only bear so much responsibility for the war. It's George Bush's fault, he said.
But the president can't hide behind the generals. This is his war. He's responsible for the mistakes and the missteps that leave our troops mired in a civil war with no end in sight.
Karen Tumulty, does all that mal-execution, all that mishandling just sail on down the river as we head into the presidential campaign season? Does it just go off nowhere or go off with George Bush?
Oh, I think, you know, not at all. If you take a look at the public opinion polls right now, President Bush is been scraping bottom essentially for a long time. I mean, he's not quite in Richard Nixon territory, but he's moving there. He has been moving there over the last couple of years. So I think that the president is very much being blamed by the public and by the politicians for where we are, and I think that is going to play out through this next election cycle. Although that's one of the reasons that you see so many. The Republican candidates are in a very, very difficult spot here because in a Republican primary, which is where the last bit of support for President Bush rests, they can't afford to get too far away from the president on Iraq strategy. At least they have not made that calculation yet. And yet they are going to have to run next year as agents of change because the country, by overwhelming majorities, is now saying that we're on the wrong track.
Let's go to Matthew in Destin, Florida. Hi, Matthew. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to comment on Jack Beatty. Jack, you're totally on point with your critique of the Bush administration. And, you know, in last year we elected the Democrats to, you know, really make a change in Iraq. We're not seeing it happening. None of the candidates now seem to be suggesting any kind of logical take on Iraq, except for Ron Paul, which, surprisingly, Republican candidate, 1 in 6, I voted against the war, and he's in support of a total withdrawal of Iraq. You know, we got to get out of this debacle.
Matthew, thanks for that. Jack, we'll come to you, but let's listen to that moment this week in the GOP debate in New Hampshire when Ron Paul and Mike Huckabee mixed it up over the war. Paul is the only anti-war candidate in the Republican field. He wants troops pulled out now.
Oh, we've dug a hole for ourselves and we've dug a hole for our party. We're losing elections and we're going down next year if we don't change it. And it has all to do with foreign policy and we have to wake up to this fact.
Even if we lose elections, we should not lose our honor. And that is more important than the Republican Party.
We have lost over 5,000 Americans over there. How many more do you want to lose? It's time we came home.
Gentlemen, thank you.
Ron Paul and Mike Huckabee duking it out. Huckabee getting the cheers with his kind of stay the course. But, Jack, what about it? You said earlier you think the Democrats are going down with their kind of convergence position here. Ron Paul says the GOP is going down with this war.
Well, yeah, these are variant readings. I was cheering Ron Paul, as a matter of fact. You know, isn't it something? He strikes me, at least, when he talks about our foreign policy, as the most triumphantly sane person we have running for president. He just says things as they are. He voted right on this war. He was against it. His prophecies have been borne out. And of course, he's regarded as some kind of fringe candidate for being so, it seems to me, lucid. But yes, I mean, it could hurt the Republicans, but I have the feeling that even as we're watching, Petraeus will be removing this issue from American politics effectively. That the Democrats will sign on to some fudge that'll basically be a non-binding resolution. That if Bush feels like it, if the weather is good enough, if the he will remove all a brigade perhaps, or make the adjustment that he has to make anyway because of the troop rotation problem, but that will be the limit of it, and it'll be essentially suspended from politics. Now, the one scenario here that I think is worth at least thinking about is, what if, in fact, the Democrats don't have an anti-war candidate? Does that mean there's an opening for Al Gore? I don't know. But I think we may be seeing something like that shifting right now.
Of course, the chemistry changing on the Republican side. Fred Thompson was not at that debate, famously, infamously, but he announced he's getting into the pool this week, formally. He announced it on Jay Leno. He also had a 14-minute webcast on his website. He talked about his experience in life. Here's the great conservative everybody's been waiting for, Fred Thompson.
I've seen my country from a lot of different vantage points. I was a teenage husband and had 3 wonderful children early. I've worked for minimum wages. for salaries more than I ever thought I'd make, and for everything in between. I've had dinners on the factory floor while working the graveyard shift, and I've dined with world leaders in foreign capitals.
And then Rudy Giuliani in the debate earlier that night saying, well, joking about Fred Thompson, who wasn't there, and about his actor background.
I like Fred a lot. I think Fred is a really, really good man. I think he's done a pretty good job of playing my part on Law and Order.
Tough guy Giuliani. Karen Tumulty on the war and beyond. How does Fred Thompson's official hat in the ring change the picture, or does it?
Well, it's interesting that the discussion of Fred Thompson, here we are many months before the Iowa caucuses, you know, in previous cycles, you know, Bill Clinton hadn't gotten in at this point. But people are asking already, is it too late for Fred Thompson? This race has started so early. He is starting out, you know, way behind everybody else. The early indications are that his campaign operation, he's already been through two campaign managers and more press people than I can count, even before he gets started. And he doesn't seem to have talks thematically, but I think that there, as much as he is trying to sort of assume Reagan's mantle, you don't look at Fred Thompson and see, you know, in where are the principles here that he's running on. But all that said, the real reason that there is an opportunity right now for Fred Thompson is that in poll after poll after poll, a majority of Republicans say we have looked at the field we've got there and we are not satisfied with it. And so Fred Thompson is coming in and claiming to be the true conservative in the race. And that could be a big problem.
Trudy Rubin, it almost seems as though each party is kind of still looking for its rudder in this presidential race. Do you see Thompson as a game changer?
You know, it just makes me laugh. It's the ultimate virtual reality campaign where a candidate's best asset is that he's an actor, so he can make people think of another actor. And he's
initials
RR,
Ronald Reagan, yeah.
Right, and he's trying to act the role of Ronald Reagan. And it just makes me think, what has our politics come to? Everyone is looking at him and seeing an actor because he wants them to see an actor. Only the actor he wants them to see is Ronald Reagan.
Well, yeah,
and
Jack,
and it's a bad actor for Mitt Romney. I agree with the Wall Street Journal's analysis that this really hurts Romney. They point out that 2/3 of Republican voters still don't know anything about Romney, and now the focus is going to be on Thompson. They'll know less. Moreover, Romney really took a hit in that debate, as I mentioned on the show a couple of weeks ago, in the course of a rambling interview. He said what he shouldn't have said. He said that his five sons, Romney did, were in effect serving the country by helping to campaign for him. The question was, why aren't they serving in the military?
In Iraq.
Mm-hmm. In Iraq. And a father, a sheriff in one of the counties up here in New Hampshire, and at the debate said to him, who had a son who's gone through two tours of duty in Iraq, said, do you know how much that hurt us? Mr. Romney, that comment you made offended us, who have a son actually there, that you would make a claim that your sons are somehow serving the country by campaigning for you. That soundbite of him just even asking that question, if Romney becomes if he strengthens, that is going to be used against him by his opponents, I think, very tellingly. So it was, I think, a very bad week. Thompson coming in and that hit at the debate for Mitt Romney.
Karen, just an actor who's late to the party? I mean, it's all seems so much still up in the air. Who does benefit here? Fox News was saying, of all things, it's John McCain who's looking strong this week, even though his poll numbers are way down.
Well, I do think that John McCain, certainly also he had a very good debate this week.
Mm-hmm.
I think the one person who this could help is Rudy Giuliani, and here's why. Rudy Giuliani has a number of positions that social conservatives just can't take. He's pro-choice. He is pro-gay rights. He is has been pro-gun control in New York, in his record in New York City. So he has to hope that the the ardent social conservative vote is so badly divided that there is going to be an opening for him. So I think that he is actually the candidate who is most likely to benefit from Fred Thompson. And in fact, that line that you just played, Tom, from the debate shows exactly how he intends to do it. I want to congratulate him for playing my character on Law and Order.
Right. Let's hear a little bit more of that character. Here's Fred Thompson. This is his week. This is before the debate or during it. He's on Fox saying what his concerns are and why he's not in the debate, but you'll find him in the campaign anyway.
On the next President's Watch, our country will make decisions that will affect our lives and our families far into the future. We can't allow ourselves to become a weaker, less prosperous, and more divided nation. Today, as before, the fate of millions across the world depends upon the unity and resolve of the American people. I talk about this tomorrow on Fred08.com. I invite you to take a look and join us.
With the Whoopi Tie-Ia wagon train music in the background. That, of course, was the ad that ran just before the debate. Let's take a call from Lake Placid, New York. Jane, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. Again, wonderful program, and I'm completely in accord with your speakers, and I'm very refreshed by your really great journalism. I have 3 points to make on the Iraq War, and I'm just going to make these very quickly. Mm-hmm. There's never talking in any detail about the state of the oil situation there, who's got it, and what's not going on, and this is really behind the Bush policy, in my opinion. Secondly, long story last night on public radio about the refugees. They're fleeing. They almost have no place left to go. What's left in Iraq? Who's left in Iraq? Everybody wants to get out. The place is a disaster. Thirdly, first and foremost, this week, I was scared to death by the story in Germany. We all know Osama bin Laden has said he wants to bankrupt the United States. Anybody who watches the news and keeps up with this, if we keep these troops over there, Bill Clinton has said we don't have anybody to defend ourselves if we're in any other troubles. We're trying to do something that's impossible, which is solve a problem that is internal in that country, and it's time we get out. I would love to have the news media concentrate on these three big points, and thank you so much for taking my call.
Jane, thank you for that. Trudy Rubin, let's go to the third, if we may. Bin Laden, we're told to expect a new video from him, but he's got, some kind of a Just for Men hair dye going on there with a black beard now. Terrorism in Germany. Do you draw the line from Germany to bin Laden? And what do you make of this promised video?
Well, the Germans were trained in Pakistan with a Central Asian terrorist group that is linked to Al-Qaeda. So there obviously is a link. The video, he has to show that he's still alive. There's been a lot of questions. He's obviously going to try to, make some appeal to the American public. You better get your people out of Iraq or you will suffer the consequences. I think that the question of whether staying longer helps or hurts, it's a very relevant one in Iraq. I mean, the Army is very worried about overstretch. There is no question. There are people in the Joint Chiefs who want a faster pullout than Petraeus does. We will certainly see at least 35,000 people leaving next year.
We're looking at a week in the news. Let's pull the curtain back a little wider. The Civil Air Patrol continues its search for missing millionaire and adventurer Steve Fawcett in Nevada's high desert.
Barring some sort of catastrophic landing, this is entirely survivable, and you've got a guy out there who has all the skills necessary.
Oprah's for Obama and maybe formally involved with his campaign.
I think that my value to him, my support of him, is probably worth more than any check that I could write, yeah.
And she could write quite a check. And the world mourned the loss, of course, this week of opera great Luciano Pavarotti, king of the high seas, dead at 71. Karen Tumbley's with us from Time Magazine, Trudy Rubin from the Philadelphia Inquirer, and our own Jack Beatty. Trudy, Karen, Jack, I want to listen to just a minute of this extraordinary kind of wayward voicemail that Senator Larry Craig left. He had said that he was or was about to say he was on his way out of the Senate, or that was his intent after the whole arrest in Minneapolis and his outing, non-outing, whatever you want to call it, as a gay senator. Here's the voicemail. He thought he was sending it to his crisis management lawyer, Billy Martin, and he was asking Martin to make a statement in front of cameras in his defense.
We've reshaped my statement a little bit to say it is my intent to resign on September 30. I think it is very important for you to make as bold a statement as you are comfortable with this afternoon, and I would hope you could make it in front of the cameras. I think it would help drive the story that I'm willing to fight, that I've got quality people out there fighting in my defense, and that this thing could take a new turn or a new shape, has that potential. Anyway, give me a buzz or give Mike a buzz on that. We're headed to my press conference now. Thank you. Bye.
Extraordinary voicemail that ended up, I guess, on the wrong phone and then in the hands of the press. Former President Bill Clinton, of all people, was then on Larry King this week, saying even though Larry Craig had been one of his worst critics, that Bill Clinton gets no satisfaction from his troubles.
We ought to recognize that this is a very traumatic time for him and his family. And whatever happens or doesn't, most of his political career was behind him. So whatever your party, we should be hoping that he and his family can work through this in a way that leaves them as whole as possible.
Lewinsky Man speaks. Karen Tumulty, what do you make of the whole Larry Craig thing? And is he gone, permanently gone now?
Oh, who knows? It was interesting to hear this from President Clinton, whom during the impeachment saga, Larry Craig had sort of famously called a dirty, naughty, nasty boy. Mm. So this whole saga has been so remarkable. I'm still trying to figure out how this voicemail ended up. It was published by roll call, but I mean, this right. was what were the chances that a misdialed phone number would get your voicemail into the hands of somebody who would know that they should run it right to the Capitol Hill newspaper?
I mean, the speculation was that he hit the wrong auto dial button, and it was somebody in his own bank of friends.
Exactly. I mean, with friends like this on your speed dial, who needs enemies? What right now the Republicans just desperately want him to go away. This is very, very different from the situation we saw, say, a couple of months ago with David Vitter, the senator from Louisiana.
Why is that? Why is it different?
On the D.C. madams. I think in large part there's a good political reason, and that is that if David Vitter were to quit, his replacement would be named by a Democratic governor in Louisiana.
That's a big difference.
If Larry Craig goes, it's a Republican governor who names his replacement. And in fact, Idaho is such a Republican state, and it is going to be such a bad year next year for Republicans. They have 22 of their seats in the Senate up for reelection. The Democrats are only going to be defending 12. That the only conceivable way that the Senate seat in Idaho could really come into play for the Democrats is if Larry Craig really tries to hang on to it. So they just want him gone so they can get a replacement in place and not have to worry about losing yet another seat in Idaho.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of this sort of sad intersection of, humanity, politics, law?
law and hypocrisy. I mean, this man voted for the amendment to ban gay marriage. He spoke against gays in the military. That's just a kind of despicable business, and I think he's basically getting what he deserves.
Yeah, well, there it is. Let's take a call from Ali in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Ali, you're on the air.
Hi, this is kind of off. It's regarding your last portion of your show. I am a mom of a serving military person. I'm just amazed through all of these reports, through all of the political stuff. The American people have to realize that still only less than 1% that's carrying these wars. It's kind of, have our guys gotten put down to the bottom of the pile simply because we have all these political things happening. And
you're saying it's the soldiers still carrying this. And, of course, news today, 7 more dead just in the last day or so.
Absolutely. And the other thing that bothers me to no end is that we have another war front, and it's the forgotten war front. It's Afghanistan. I am just
totally appalled, as are a lot of soldiers in field. They have to sign on a dotted line that they're not going to say anything bad about where they are, what they're doing, but they're exhausted. And I'm thinking, okay, you guys carry on. Yeah, it's a bad situation. We should leave them in there and stuff. Who's going to truly speak up for our people on the ground?
Trudy Rubin, what do you say to that? You've made the case that we must stay. Ollie's got a child on the front line with that other very small percentage of Americans who are serving there.
There's no question that there's going to have to be a drawdown next year. That's what I said, at least 35,000 troops, because the military cannot sustain that kind of presence without having to extend the tour of duty beyond the 15-month tours that Secretary Gates has said will be the rule.
But that leaves 100,000 plus still out there. Is there a fair burden sharing here?
Well, you know, take it up with President Bush. I mean, I think that, frankly, it's going to be up to the next president to solve this. There's going to have to be a regional diplomatic conference that brings in the UN, where the U.S. uses the kind of muscle that it should have used a long time ago to try to deal with Iran, with Syria, get the neighbors who have an interest in a stable Iran, and they do under certain conditions, to work to help a stable Iraq. This administration can't do that and won't do that. I think it's going to be up to the next president, but it's not going to help the U.S. military if this whole thing ends in a debacle either. That's what I meant by damned if you do, damned if you don't. So I think that there will be a drawdown, and it probably will be to lower than 100,000 so that Gates can keep his promise. I just don't think that you can set the timeline for the final pullout until there's been some more stability in the provinces. For the first time, there is a small chance that that could happen for the military's sake as well as for our sake. I think that that needs to be pursued. Bush created this mess. The next president is going to have to heal it.
Barack Obama, I mean, there's a lot of fudging going on, but Obama's still talking about, as I hear it, a bigger pullout, maybe. Oprah standing up for Obama this week, Jack Beatty, and maybe even getting semi-formally involved in his campaign. What do you make of the Oprah embrace, endorsement, big party at her California ranch this weekend, a whole lot of money coming in? What do you make of it, Jack?
Well, I was surprised. I don't know what Trudy and Karen think, but I was surprised to see in the stories the effect that George Bush's appearance on Oprah in the 2000 campaign had. He was trailing badly, I think, by 10 points among women. He appeared on the program. He talked about his marriage. He was there with his wife. Mm-hmm. He got the Oprah treatment, and within days, he had almost drawn even with Gore on that metric. She has 8 million viewers a day, and she speaks to them at some very intimate level. The people trust her. Her viewers do. And the pollsters refer to the Oprah bounce. Now, will this work for Obama? One doesn't know. But, you know, you do have that Bush precedent to show that she really does have reach.
Karen, tell me, what about it? Does Oprah bring it home for Obama? And does a semi-formal relationship with his campaign strengthen her endorsement or undercut it somehow?
Well, you know, I mean, but one thing that people don't mention is that Al Gore was also on Oprah in that same period. I think they were just a few weeks apart. And in fact, I recall being in the pool the day that Al Gore was on Oprah, and it was also a good appearance. So, you know, I don't know how much that endorsements really matter that much in the end when people decide who they're going to vote for.
Sure works for books and book clubs when Oprah picks it up.
That's true. That's true. But I think that choosing a president is a different kind of decision. And, you know, money has not been a Barack Obama's problem to date either. So, I mean, he's had a lot of buzz, a lot of celebrity, and a lot of money coming in. And yet Hillary Clinton continues to increase her lead in the polls.
Let's go to Mark in Burlington, Vermont. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to comment on the nuclear weapons that were supposedly flown across the U.S.
Not supposedly. That is confirmed. They were accidentally and extensively flown around.
Although how you would necessarily recognize a nuclear munition on a plane above you is kind of confusing to me. But my comment would be that, one, there's too many checks and balances for that to accidentally happen, and that the Barksdale base in Louisiana has routinely been used to stage Air Force towards the Mideast.
And so you smell something afoot here. Of course, Mark, let us look at that. This is the story that the Air Force came out and made a clean breast of it, announced it. An Air Force B-52 bomber flying around the central U.S. last week with six cruise missiles, affixed under its wing right there out on the pylon, and they were armed with nuclear warheads, the Air Force said, were mistakenly attached to the airplane's wings, stuffed into those cruise missiles. Stratofortress bomber based at Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota, transporting a dozen advanced cruise missiles to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana August 30th. And the announcement said they were inadvertently, half of those, six of them, loaded with nuclear warheads. Here's Pentagon Press Secretary Jeff Morrell talking about the Air Force's major mishap.
The Air Force is currently investigating an error made last Thursday in the transfer of munitions, as you mentioned, from Minot Air Force Base to Barksdale Air Force Base aboard a B-52 Stratofortress.
Okay, I don't know where to go with this. Trudy Rubin, apparently people didn't even know they were in there. The plane was sitting on the tarmac somewhere for 10 hours with nukes on its wing, and the folks didn't even know. Representative Ed Markey, co-chairman of the House Task Force on Nonproliferation, calls it the complete breakdown of the Air Force command and control over enough nuclear weapons to destroy several cities. How could that happen, Trudy?
I just find it utterly astonishing. There has been so much discussed and written in the past over whether after the breakup of the Soviet Union, Russia had control over its nuclear weapons, whether their rocket command was adequate, whether the weapons were secure. To have something like this happen, and this is the kind of thing, I don't know, in a parliamentary system where the Secretary of Defense would resign, it is astonishing to me. I mean, I don't know any more than was in the papers, but I find it almost impossible to believe that the controls were so inadequate that this could happen, that there weren't all kinds of codes and command orders that would have to go forward for a nuclear weapon to be released. I think this is a scandal that deserved to be a major headline on page one, not inside, as in many papers. And I think that the report has to be pretty thorough, and some heads should roll if indeed this was simply a, quote, mishap.
Well, let's go to Mark's suspicion here. Another thing in the news this week is kind of, you know, more drumbeat on a U.S. attack on Iran.
Are you ready
to draw lines here? Is there a push on to go after Iran? Is it, you know, I mean, this is
not
sheer speculation.
Not with taking a weapon across the states. This has to be, actually, I shouldn't have put mishaps in quotes. This has to be a mess up of the first order, and we need to know why. I can't believe this was done on purpose. This does not help make a case for bombing Iran. Just the opposite. You know, if we don't know what we're doing with nukes, not that we're going to. Not that even the rumors are bombing Iran. And by the way, Rudy Giuliani has a key foreign policy advisor, Norman Potteritz, who has written a book called Why We Must Bomb Iran. I think that's the time bomb in Rudy Giuliani's campaign when people realize that this guy, you know, has advisors who are pushing for the next war. But that's another story.
Is Rudy Giuliani against that notion? I mean, he likes to talk tough.
I certainly haven't heard him say it. He hasn't been questioned about Potteritz.
Jack Beatty?
Yeah, well in the debate, he said, Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. He did also say that President Reagan managed to, you know, essentially, in his view, defeat the Soviet Union or get them to stand down by talking to the, you know, by negotiating. But he said negotiating with missiles pointed at their cities. So he was not saying we're going to bomb them. He seemed to be saying the Reagan pattern of, toughness plus diplomacy, but we'll have to see.
Karen Tumblety, we just got half a minute. There were nukes in the air, a lot of anticipation on the ground. Petraeus and Ryan Crocker, the ambassador, come next week. Is the table already set? Do we know the outcome already, or could there be some surprise dynamic that comes out of this big progress report? What do you think?
You know, I think that the pieces are being put into place for a, you know, Congress voting for something that is more symbolic than substantive, and this essentially being pushed off to the next president.
And that means a year and more and more. It's been great to have all of you. Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent with Time Magazine, joining us from Washington. Karen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Trudy Rubin, foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, author of Willful Blindness. Trudy, thanks. Welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you.
And Jack, good to have you as always. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.